Hello, it's 4 o'clock. I want to start with the lightning talks. We have first few German lightning talks and then later some in English. Mike, bitte.
Okay, check. Ja, Mike Wiemel, Initiator des Projekts Flyer Soziotope. Vor 8 Jahren, sprich 1997, haben wir begonnen mit der größten, vermutlich größten Flyer-Sammlung der Welt und öffentlich zur Schaustellung dieses Mediums. Wir haben im Akut, was ein kleines besetztes Kulturvereinchen damals war, eine Galerie gehabt und begonnen mit 30.000, 40.000 Stück an der Wand. Sind daraufhin in ungefähr 12 Ländern gewesen, haben 50 Ausstellungen insgesamt präsentiert, auf großen Festivals, Kongressen, aber auch in kleinen Galerien, Clubs. Und haben immer weiter gesammelt. Die Idee war, sammeln kann man nur, wenn man wandert, besonders wenn es um ein Medium geht wie Flyer. Also Flyer, denke ich, ist jedem Begriff. Ich wollte jetzt eigentlich so the best of hier im Hintergrund einfach nur vorbeirattern lassen. Ihr könnt auf der Website aber die ganzen, oder wenigstens einen guten Teil der Daten sehen, flyersoziotope.net. Wir haben 8 Jahre lang relativ erfolgreich, glaube ich, uns am Leben erhalten mit diesem Projekt. Haben auch 1998 hier in der Kongresshalle eine Ausstellung gemacht bei Berlin Beta. Die letzten 3 Jahre damit verbracht, ein Buch zu produzieren, das 600 Seiten dick ist, was ich nicht dabei habe, was man aber in fast jedem guten Buchladen finden kann, weltweit. Es ist so eine Art Versuch, einen Überblick zu geben über diese Welt der Propagandakultur, der Grafik, aber auch musikzentrierten Propagandakultur. Es sind auch viele abwegige oder Aspekte der Medienkultur drin, also Flyer für Webseiten, Flyer für Radiosender, Flyer für Kunstausstellungen. Flyer Soziotope versucht eigentlich weiterzumachen. Wir hatten 2002 eine Förderung von der Kulturstiftung des Bundes erhalten, um aus dieser großen Sammlung eine weitere große Ausstellung zu machen, aber auch ein Buch zu destillieren. Das ist uns, glaube ich, ganz gut gelungen. Jetzt stehen wir sozusagen kurz vor Anfang 2006 vor der großen Frage, was machen wir mit unseren etwa 450.000 Flyern aus 90 Ländern, die im Moment in ca. 60 Umzugskisten in einem nicht beheizten Lager rumstehen. Wir haben 2003 mit 5 Maschinen, 5 Arbeitsplätzen und 35 Praktikanten gescannt, also wir haben ungefähr 15.000 digitalisiert. Seitdem kriege ich pro Woche zwischen 2 und 5 Kuverts von Grafikern auf der ganzen Welt, die teilweise mir ihre CDs schicken, aber zum großen Teil halt auch die realen Sachen, die sie in den letzten 10, 20 Jahren gebaut haben. Das Ganze hat natürlich auch eine gewisse Tiefe. Die letzten 10 Jahre sind natürlich sehr kunst- oder kulturhistorisch jetzt vielleicht nicht so der Oberbringer. Da gibt es Leute, die anderer Meinung sind übrigens auch. Aber das Ganze geht zurück bis 1970 aus Dresden. Das sind also die ältesten, die wir jetzt sozusagen als Flyer in unserer Sammlung haben. Und das Ganze hat schon eine gewisse merkwürdige Attraktivität, also man kann damit auch im Rahmen von Ausstellungen unheimlich feststellen, dass das wirklich viele Leute betrifft. Ja? Also Flyer haben so eine gewisse Sexiness, also es macht einfach Spaß, sich mit den Medien zu beschäftigen und sie sind auch sehr inspirierend. Große Frage wäre der Denksport für den CCC, wenn sich jemand berufen fühlt, uns zu supporten. Wir haben eine Datenbank online, die ist im Moment sehr barebone. Wir haben noch nicht mal unter die Links auf unseren Templates sozusagen die History about our project und all diese Geschichten organisiert. Aber es ist eine an sich sehr gute Datenbank von Thomas Kaulmann programmiert, der orang.org gemacht hat. Es ist sozusagen meta.orang.org, glaube ich, ist die Datenbank auch im Netz zu finden. Die liegt auch bei SourceForge, die wir da einsetzen. Es geht im Prinzip darum, vielleicht später noch, ja, wenn noch jemand Interesse hat. Es geht darum, aus dieser Datenbank eigentlich so eine Art Continuity zu produzieren oder aus der Sammlung. Es geht auch nicht unbedingt nur um unsere Sammlung, sondern um die Verknüpfung von vielen, vielen Datenbanken, die im Netz schon sind. Also so eine Art zentrale Stelle zu schaffen, von wo aus jede Art von Flyer-Kultur recherchiert werden kann. Das Ganze hat auch ein paar Copyright- und rechtliche Aspekte, die ganz interessant sind. Also viele Veranstaltungen sind illegal im Sinne von Gewerbeamt, GEMA, allen möglichen Geschichten. Finanzamt vielleicht auch noch ein wichtiger Punkt. Also wenn es zu sehr recherchierbar ist, dann ist dieses gibt man etwas preis, was man gemeinhin möglicherweise Indizien nennt. Das Ganze ist dann auch länder- oder regional spezifisch unter Umständen. So gesehen muss man sich ein bisschen den Kopf machen, wie man das damit umgeht. Wir würden also sehr gerne unsere 10.000 oder 15.000 Flyer, die digital online sind im Moment, weiter ausbauen. Wir würden gerne eine Art Workflow entwickeln, wie Registered Users uns Uploads schicken können. Also, dafür gibt es natürlich Vorbilder im Netz. Das kann man aber natürlich auch versuchen, in Kooperation mit vielen anderen Datenbanken, die schon da sind, machen. Und ich hoffe, dass wir in irgendeiner Weise auch wieder Sponsoren oder Supporter finden, die also auch die Kosten für so ein Unterfangen ein bisschen decken. Also wer hilft, kann gerne einsteigen und wer nicht hilft, kann uns gerne trotzdem irgendwelche Tipps geben oder sagen, so geht's nicht. FlyerSoziotope.net, Mike Riemel, danke.
Ja, danke Mike. Nun, Irrlicht möchte Media Wiki im Unterricht vorstellen.
Ich muss noch ein bisschen runter machen, das habe ich versteht. Okay, also erstmal danke, dass ich hier sprechen darf. Mein Name ist Annike Wolf. Ich werde über Media Wiki im Unterricht sprechen. Der Vortragstyp wird ein Erfahrungsbericht sein. Basis hierfür war ein Seminar, was ich im Sommersemester 2005 abgehalten habe. Und auch an weitere Beobachtungen an anderen Seminaren, die dann auch eben auf dieser Plattform gelaufen sind. Zu meiner Person. Ich bin wissenschaftliche Mitarbeiterin in der Fakultät Kulturgeschichte und Kulturkunde der Universität Hamburg. Das heißt, das Umfeld, in dem das Ganze stattfindet, ist eins, in dem sowohl Lehrende als auch Lernende in der Regel über keine formale technische Ausbildung verfügen. Ich bin zusätzlich seit April 2004 aktive Mitarbeiterin in der deutschsprachigen Wikipedia. Das hat dann im Grunde auch dazu geführt, dass ich diese Software dafür ausgewählt habe. Einmal halt, weil ich selbst über einen gewissen Kenntnisstand in der Anwendung verfüge und zum Zweiten über ein informelles Netzwerk, was mir halt auch ermöglicht, irgendwie Fragen zu klären, falls welche auftauchen. Eine zusätzliche Motivation war natürlich auch, überhaupt ein Wiki im Unterricht zu testen, um sozusagen einen Vergleich dazu zu haben, wie funktioniert das in der Wikipedia, wie funktioniert das, wenn man es in einen anderen Kontext einbindet. Ich hatte mir außerdem erhofft für das Seminar selbst eine leicht verfügbare Seminardokumentation, die Möglichkeit der Präsentation der Arbeitsergebnisse für die Studierenden, eine Vergleichbarkeit auch der Arbeiten. Normalerweise ist es ja so, man gibt seine Hausarbeit ab, dann redet man mit seinem Dozenten darüber und kriegt entweder einen Schein oder nicht. Und so kann man halt auch abgleichen, okay, was machen eigentlich andere dafür, um einen Schein zu bekommen. Das Seminar war so aufgebaut, es hat erst eine Einführungssitzung zur Software gegeben. Dann gab es mehrere Sitzungen mit kleineren Arbeitsaufträgen und zum Schluss ging es darum, einen längeren Text für das Wiki zu verfassen. Zu den Ergebnissen kann man sagen, schon wie angenommen, die Technikkompetenzen waren sehr, sehr unterschiedlich. Also einige Leute haben sich halt eingeloggt, haben angefangen zu arbeiten und es war okay. Für andere ging es halt überhaupt nicht. Das heißt, was ich denke als erstes sehr, sehr wesentlich ist, dass im Seminar selbst tatsächlich auch nochmal eine Einführung geben wird, wie man mit der Software arbeitet. Das wird nicht immer gemacht, also wie gesagt, ich hab das System aufgesetzt und viele Leute, andere Dozenten wollen es halt auch benutzen, weigern sich aber im Grunde sozusagen von ihrer Seminarzeit Zeit abzugeben für eine Einführung. Die sagen halt, okay, die Leute können die Hilfe lesen, das reicht ganz schön, das reicht nicht. Was sich als relativ gut erwiesen hat, ist halt die Aufteilung in kleine Arbeitsschritte, dass die Leute sich langsam an die Software gewöhnen können. Möglicherweise wäre auch zu überlegen, ob man halt nicht das ganze Seminar so konzipiert. Probleme. Wo Probleme aufgetaucht sind, war zuerst einmal, ob es wirklich ein Problem ist, es fraglich ist, Unsicherheit bezüglich des Tatbestandes der Öffentlichkeit. Das ist natürlich auch immer so, ein System ist natürlich auch immer in gewisser Weise eine Kontrollinstanz. Also wenn es sehr genau Meyer, Müller, Schulze haben zum 13.12. ihr Protokoll nicht abgegeben. Das muss man auch mal ganz klar sagen. Und es hat sich auch in die Richtung halt ausgewirkt, dass zum Beispiel die Diskussionsseiten des Systems einfach nicht für Diskussionen benutzt worden sind. Dafür war dann einfach eher das Seminar selbst oder andere Kontexte wesentlich. Wo es direkt Schwierigkeiten beim Umgang mit der Software gegeben hat, also ganz klassischer Fall, die größte Hürde ist einfach die Erstbearbeitung. Das kennt man aber auch aus der Wikipedia. Da sind Fälle bekannt, wo Leute ein Dreivierteljahr gelesen haben, bevor sie überhaupt einen Edit gemacht haben. Das heißt, man sollte möglichst am Anfang des Seminars die Leute auch wirklich in den Rechner setzen und sagen, okay, hier, drückt auf Speichern, ihr könnt es machen, es geht nichts kaputt. Was für mich relativ verwunderlich war, ist glaube ich auch ein klassisches Problem, aber ich habe es überhaupt nicht erwartet, waren Navigationsprobleme. Also es gab eine Hauptseite und dann gab es dann da immer sozusagen weiterführende Seiten und selbst wenn da ganz klar stand, Gruppe A hier, haben die Leute gefragt, wo soll ich da was reinschreiben. Da bin ich auch relativ ratlos, wie man das einfach noch expliziter machen kann oder auch noch einfacher machen kann, dass das funktioniert. Auch ein weiteres klassisches Problem ist einfach, dass es also die Leute sowas wie einen Quelltext einfach noch nie gesehen haben. Und selbst wenn man ihnen sagt, okay, ihr könnt nicht einfach euer Word-Dokument reinkopieren und es ihnen auch zeigt, also über einen Beamer zeigt, die Leute es aus irgendeinem Grund also doch nicht verstehen. Also es hat einfach mehrere Fälle gegeben, wo die Leute es halt einfach trotzdem so reinkopiert haben. Was auch aufgetreten ist, ist auch nicht unbedingt ein Problem. Habe ich aber auch verwundert, ist, dass die Leute kaum tatsächlich online arbeiten oder tatsächlich auch online editieren. Das heißt, sie haben ihre Texte vorgeschrieben, haben sie dann reinkopiert und dann gespeichert. Das mag einmal auch daran liegen, auch an so einem klassischen Publikationsverständnis, dass man halt eine fertige Hausarbeit abgibt und nicht einfach erstmal den Mittelteil schreibt, wie man es vielleicht in einem Wiki machen würde, dann die Anleitung und dann den Schluss oder so. Was da natürlich auch noch dazu kommt, ist die technische Ausstattung, was mich auch relativ überrascht hat. Es gibt natürlich einen Rechnerpool an der Uni, aber viele Leute arbeiten halt zu Hause und tatsächlich auch noch mit einem Call-by-Call-Zugang und 56K-Modem. Das war einfach auch was, womit ich nicht so unbedingt gerechnet hatte.
Ich muss dich leider unterbrechen, weil die Zeit ist zu Ende.
Einen Punkt habe ich noch. Ich bin jetzt auch schon beim letzten. Was man halt auch berücksichtigen muss in so einem Umfeld ist einfach, also dass das WWW halt als Pull-Technologie funktioniert. Das heißt, die Leute müssen sich die Inhalte holen aktiv und das tun sie auch nicht unbedingt. Das heißt, es gab zum Beispiel mal eine Terminverschiebung, die dann, was weiß ich, ein Drittel der Leute einfach nicht mitbekommen hat. Das heißt, man müsste gucken, macht man dann noch was über Mailinglisten oder ähnliches. Ich bin noch bis 5:30 oben in der Wikipedia-Ecke. Wer noch mit mir reden möchte, danke fürs Zuhören.
Ja, danke Irrlicht. Und jetzt bitte ich Spaceman für EcologyNet.
Hello, thank you for coming. Unfortunately, I have to read this. It's about the ecologic sensitive internet. EcologyNet is an idea for the future. We show you steps to an ecologic sensitive internet. Ecologic Net aims for the end user and service providers. We are the net. There are no grid without current. In this moment, all appliances connected into the internet in Germany will draw as much power as two big nuclear power stations can produce. In 2010, in this country, we will eat up the whole energy of three nuclear power stations only for internet usage. Internet and communication now draws more current than lighting in Germany. Nobody can make excuses. We all will take part. Energy is by far too much reason of conflicts in this world up to today for our benefit, in respect to energy. Global warming starts with power supplies under our desk. It is the whole zoo of boxes and cases which are just heating quietly, whether they are in use or not. If electricity raises its costs, communication will end up being expensive too. Until now, we relied on manufacturers that they will engineer and produce devices that take care for the environment and its energy savings. We rely on it, engineers, that they do not implement senseless routines which consume too much and drive the load of microprocessors too high. We rely on our energy service provider that he handles its business with care. Too much trust. Makers will disregard this problem so long as they could not sell their heavy appliances to us. IT professionals will use up useless routines as long they have enough capacity on a system. Energy providers will sell their product as long nobody cares how tension is generated into the wall socket. While facing all peak, Greenpeace estimates a 50% potential of new energy only in energy savings. This means our hardware would generate more cash for your business, or on the other turn, you will pay for sure more in the next years. We have an example on our homepage of a 10-watt PC where it could head to. Your role model will change anything. You have got the power and you're the guilty conscience of an apocalyptic projection to our society. You trailblaze the route where technology goes. Energy management with use of IP technology will be more easy. In 2001, I suggested Greenpeace to come up with a green internet. In 2003, the energy provider of Greenpeace, together with an ISP, they had created the first so-called nuclear power-free server. Overseas, we have spotted some ISPs which use renewable power sources. On our website, EcologyNet, we document our knowledge and keep a list of such providers. More success, I cannot tell you. I hope next year I will be here in a better condition with a bigger list and a bigger web portal. Our internet-based communication and telephony are not innocent in regard to our energy usage. You can do the maths for your own home. For your own, how much you can save to leverage bills for electricity. We will pay the consequences, at least in a declined living standard. If shining examples and teases you on this Congress don't change something in this respect, nobody will care ever about this. Switch off radical your devices after use. Think about the necessity of test and reference systems, whether they have to be always switched on. If you buy a machine or you have to write tests for a magazine, for example, watch out just to take care of running costs of the power consumed of these appliances you test. Go and write your suggestions into our wiki. We need lots of cases, of case studies, much more than we've got now. And go to EcologyNet, ecology with a double E in the end, and thank you for listening.
I just want to say that there are still 3 chairs here, so you must stand. Christian will... Christian here for a CoreWars project. Christian für CoreWars project, ist er hier? Okay, dann überspringen wir das. Oliver Leistert, DPG for SMS.
Hi. I like privacy and I miss privacy in mobile phones. And this is a crypto phone that Rob developed some years ago, which does speech encryption. But I miss a simple application in Java running on mobile phones that simply encrypts and decrypts SMS. And I'm not a coder myself. I only use technology. And I want to take this opportunity to ask some some people here to get together and build a simple Java program running on mobile phones using the Bouncy Castle libraries, which provide already PGP libraries and do that thing. It can be done in a modular way. So key generation does not have to be done in the beginning. That can be left out and added later. And other people can contribute later if it's done in modular ways. So anybody interested in doing that, please come outside and we can exchange emails and organize that. That's all. Thank you.
Ist Christian mittlerweile hier? Okay, dann I will ask Ramses.
Hello, I want to talk to you about a very unusual subject, about an RC bot showing very anomalous and very interesting behavior. A few months ago, we set up an RC bot on an RC channel on the RC net, and we provided a brain for him. That's a small TCL script which stores everything people say on the channel and chooses randomly just a sentence or something else as an answer to somebody else. And the bot answers to people, and what we found out very quickly is that the bot gives answers which make sense. I want to give you some examples, and afterwards I want to discuss how can we explain that behavior of the bot. I'll try to translate them. They are all in German. Somebody says, I want to get some food for me, and the bot answers, well, I hear the ham on the pizza. That isn't stored in the database that the bot can react seeing food by saying pizza or ham. It's just reacting on the word I. He's choosing just a word from somebody who says something and reacts with a sentence which contains this word, or a smiley or whatever. The second example is, you're talking a whole bunch of rubbish now. Bot is called Susiline. Susiline, do you know that? Well, in recent times, I think it got really bad. The bot answers himself. The next example is, it says, hi Ramses, that's me. And the bot answers, well, he seems to be more in Egypt than in Germany. And Egypt isn't connected to Ramses in the database. It's just a random result of what the bot chooses from the database. The fourth example, somebody says, I got my exam, and the bot says, I knew it. And the last example shows that this behavior appeared from the start. It didn't just appear when the beta database was large enough. It's started at the very beginning. Somebody said, why said Susiline goodbye to you right now? And Susiline answered, Susiline is learning now. And I think this is very impressing. Okay, so, now the theory is about that. Somebody could say this is just chance. It's just a certain probability that the bot will, the script will choose a sentence which makes sense. But I think that's not enough. Chance is not an explanation, for me, in my opinion, which is enough for that. The second explanation is there is an acausal link between what the bot says and what chatter says. That's called synchronicity. It's a theory of a German or Swiss psychologist called C.G. Jung. But I think that's not a good explanation either, because I think we need a causal link between what happens here, between what the chatter says and what the bot says. And my my opinion is that we should just call this communication. There is a very simple communication theories which just say there is a sender and a receiver, and the sender says something, sends a message, and the receiver receives it and understands it. I don't know any communication theory which says the sender has to do this intentionally by knowing what he does. And so I think this is a psychological process, what happens here. We say something, the chat says something, the bot answers, and we interpret what the bot says in a sensible way. And that's what happens always in communication. If you say something to me, I don't know if you know what you're saying. I don't know if you're thinking about it. You could just be a machine reacting to me. And I'm interpreting your answer in a sensible way. And that's the same what we're doing here.
I'm sorry, the time's over.
Yep, I'm finished.
Ah, okay, great. Thanks. Ja, ich möchte noch mal fragen, ob Christian von den Corvos mittlerweile hier ist.
Ich stehe nicht mehr im Wiki, ne? Ja,
aber. Okay, gut. So, habe ich einen zu alten Ausdruck. Dann ja, John Gilmore, NSA Wiretap Investigation.
I'm here to talk about how the U.S. National Security Agency is currently engaged in some questionable, more questionable than usual, wiretapping. And I don't know how much of a news story this has been over here. It's been a big story in the United States in the last few weeks. The New York Times broke the story saying that people from inside the agency had come to them with a story about how they were wiretapping U.S. citizens, even though they're specifically prohibited from doing that. And then the following day, President Bush got on the television and basically admitted to doing it, and furthermore said he's going to keep doing it, and he thinks he has the power to do it because of the resolution that the Congress passed allowing him to go to war, which didn't ever say anything about wiretapping. So this has raised a lot of issues. For once, the U.S. Congress is actually pursuing its role of challenging the executive branch. And there'll be a lot of hearings in January, et cetera, about this. The challenge is in figuring out what NSA is actually doing. Because, of course, they say this is a very highly classified program. They're not saying much about what actually they're doing. But by piecing together some clues, I have a theory that I will tell you guys, and I'm interested in any further thoughts or discussion you have. My theory is that what they're doing is not monitoring the conversations, but they're doing traffic analysis. They're recording the phone number that is calling, the phone number that is being called, and the duration of each call that goes from the United States to outside or from outside to the United States. We already know that they're doing something, that they're doing that and probably more to people all over the world, including here. But They're not supposed to do it to their own citizens. Well, I understand. I think it would be a better place if they wouldn't do it to anybody. But the problem is you get into feedback loops when your own government runs communication in your own country and feeds that information back to high levels of government. Then they start using that against their political opponents, and it becomes rapidly possible to build a dictatorship. So my theory is that they were doing similar taps throughout the world, but whenever there was a U.S. phone number involved, they would have to throw that information away, unless they specifically knew that the person at that U.S. phone number was not a citizen. And what they probably did was, first they just turned off those filters and said, oh, well, if we monitor a telephone call in Germany and it's going through a U.S. number, we'll just keep that information. Second, they also appear to be wiretapping at telephone switches and other you know, internet switches inside the United States that connect to international fibers. So besides tapping in all their usual overseas locations, they're also dragging information out of switches in the continental United States. And this is not authorized by any law. I mean, there's no law that contemplated the idea that NSA would watch who's talking to who inside the country or between American citizens and people outside. There's a court set up called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, whose job is to approve warrants for exceptions to this rule that they can't monitor people in the U.S. And so if there's someone who they have evidence to believe this is a spy, this is a terrorist, an agent of a foreign power, they can bring that evidence to the secret court and apply for a warrant to wiretap that person even though they're in the U.S. And that court has handled something between 100 and 1,500 warrants every year. It's been going up, particularly in the last few years. But they have no procedure whatsoever to authorize a warrant to tap everybody and then sort of filter out that information. Now, part of the reason I suspect this is because the people in the government who are talking about this are drawing a very fine distinction between detecting phone calls and monitoring phone calls. They're saying that we're detecting the calls of terrorists. And so, for example, if they record this information for a year and stuff it all into a database, then when they catch someone somewhere in the world who they believe is a terrorist, they'll get that guy's phone number. And then they'll go back to the database and say, who are all the people who called him? Who are all the people who he called? And they'll start following those people or trying to get surveillance warrants from this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court against those people.
Sorry, the time's over. Do you want to make a last sentence or something, last point?
So it's an interesting issue that and there is possibility for real change in this because large parts of America are upset about this, and I encourage you all to follow it and express your own opinions.
The next is Ludwig Jaffe. Jaffe, Kernel Excellent Device.
Let me see. sometimes some optical time is off. There was something moving. No, it's what?
Lightning talk.
Okay. Nothing is working. Okay, this is working, good. Maybe the X is working. Okay. The frequencies might be the problem. Yes, okay, but the problem is that the machine is okay.
Yeah.
Let somebody other talk so I can fix the problem with the X to reduce your resolution. The resolution. I configure it and then.
OEL is 9P distributed file system.
System at Bell Labs. It's developed. It's derived from the 8th edition Unix Research Network File System, which has nothing to do with SAN and NFS. It was started developing in 1985 as part of the Plan 9 system by Ken Thompson and Rob Pike. Over the years, it has been used in Inferno and various other systems. Now it's ported to Linux and. And there is implementation in Python and Java. 9P is a network file system, but its main purpose is to give access to all sorts of resources transparently over the network, not just static files. It's designed to be really simple. It only has 14 basic operations compared with, I think, NFS3 has over 30, and NFS4 has more, something like that. And it has a flexible authentication and encryption mechanisms that are transparent for the client, both the client and the server. And it can run over any in-order, reliable delivery service, so like TCP IP, RA, UDP, PPP, PC bus, serial port, shared memory. It's transparent. It can run over any transport layer. There's multiple implementations, as I have said, for various systems and various languages. 9P is mostly used as the glue that holds the Plan 9 and Inferno's distributed systems together. All resources in Plan 9 and Inferno are file systems that offer a file tree which any client can read and write from. For example, the IP stack is a file system. The graphic system is a file system too. That allows us to give transparent access to any client over the network to all these resources. For example, Plan 9 only has 30 syscalls. It has no IO control. There is no root. All this is thanks to using this simple mechanism to export all resources using the traditional read-write-open operations. One example is SLASHNET, is the IP stack, which is also a file system, and there is no need for NAT. You just import the SLASHNET file system from the gateway, and your application will read and write from files there and be able to open connections transparently. There are some 9P servers which are also filters, and they use forward the packets, the operations, and gather statistics. For example, IO stats, you can run it in your namespace, and it will give you statistics of input-output operations you're executing. Private namespaces let you mount and manipulate your namespace dynamically and without affecting other processes. That has many uses, especially for sandboxing and security. What uses outside Plan 9 and Infernet has, it can be used as a replacement for NFS. At Los Alamos National Laboratory, they are using it in Linux for distributing tasks to big clusters of over 1,000 units. And the way they do it, they can mount from each one of the nodes in the cluster, they can mount it into a single from a single place, and they can write tasks into files that then the nodes execute. And then there is a WikiFS, Inferno. There's Inferno Grid, which Inferno can run on any other operating system like Windows and Mac OS X and any Unix variant. And this is used in many universities for if they want to offer certain resources to all across a big heterogeneous network, they can install Inferno on all the boxes and then they can share resources very easily. There is various implementations I was saying before. There's a list of URLs and implementations for various systems, which you cannot see right now, but when I put the slides online, you will surely be able to see them. And that's all.
Thank you very much.
KD, for those who do not know, in short, is a FPGA-based card that is to be plugged into the PC. It's connected to the PCI bus. It contains some FPGAs. We plan to have 6. Maybe we get 8. It depends on some electrical problems we may get with the local bus because of loading and things like that and reflecting waves. So maybe there are some technical problems that we may face. I did a lecture about that at the What the Hack and last year, so I will only talk about some differences we thought about. The old version has had the concept that we have the local wishbone bus, so as you might know, on opencourse.org, the cores are made so that they can communicate via a wishbone bus. It's a quite big bus that has address lines, data lines, but it can also have bus transfers. But the problem is that this bus may be slow because the electrical interface is not that good because we have much load. If you can compare it with PCI, it's not that fast because you have many loads that are attached to that bus. So we have an additional idea that is the so-called transputer link. So we thought about the old transputer cards, and they are interconnected with each other. So we introduced some links. So if you make some cores that use that, they can communicate with each other, and they get some small routing mechanisms. So if the CPU that loads the cores with a configuration engine, I will show it the next picture, then a routing table can be set up so that, for example, if that FPGA wants to talk with that, it will be routed here or here, depending on the load of the bus. But this does not work dynamically because it needs too much real estate on the silicon. So we have the PC control the registers that says where the packets are routed. This is the one, and the next is the configuration thing. Did this open? Yes. Okay. So this is a reconfiguration thing. As the FPGAs are not flash-based, they are SRAM-based, so they can be dynamically reconfigured, so you have other cores. The magic from the kernel accelerator device is to have a kernel driver that talks to a core, and the IP core does the hard work, and the kernel driver does the interconnect to the user land. And the reconfiguration device consists of a register and some small interface that is built into the bridge FPGA, but logically it is connected to the Wishbahn bus. And then you have there's a small bus that controls the configuration CPLD. Maybe it fits into a CPLD, or we have to use a small flash-based FPGA from Actel or some company. It has to be flash-based because it has to be alive when power comes and not if we configure it. The function of this device is controlled by some switches, but we also have some LEDs for debugging. For example, if we have the first samples of the board, we want to do something, and so we have the possibility to talk to this register where we know the address, and then we can check that the bridge works. So it's very important that we have some means of blinking lights to see if something if there's some life in the card. The reconfiguration can be done with different things. There are two flash devices. One is the factory flash and one is the user flash. The factory flash is for configuring the bridge, because if the bridge is not configured, you will not see it on the PCI bus, and so you will never talk to the KD, so it's better to configure it after reset. If there is a mistake in the core of the bridge, it is possible to date it to make an update, and so the update is done with the user flash. You can use those registers and this reconfiguration thing to update the flash, but you will not be able to update the factory flash, because it's there for security that the board will boot even if you have flashed some errors, no code inside. Then another feature that we want to have is the MMC card, because MMC cards or SD cards are very cheap at this time, so we can put all the contents of an FPGA inside this card, so you can configure all the FPGAs at boot time. It has the advantage, for example, if you want to play with some new computer architectures, you can build a computer without the normal CPU. You put the CPU inside one of these FPGAs, plug the whole thing in a passive PCI backplane, and so you can play around, for example, with the open source Spark clone called Leon or so. So this is, I know this is a quite big project, but I think we can start with the schematics and the prototypes. Maybe we get it in next year or next winter we get some hardware. Any questions? Okay. Next one.
Yeah, we have some free time, spontaneous lightning talk maybe, because Core was not here and we have a free slot. Okay. Yeah, okay, then I have just one point. I make it in German, because my English is very bad. Ja, ihr habt vielleicht gesehen, dass überall hier so Indie-Print-Ausgaben ausliegen, und wenn euch was Interessantes noch auffällt und worüber ihr schreiben wollt, dann geht auf indiemedia.org und schreibt einen Bericht, damit halt nicht nur Heise und Spiegel Online diesen Kongress halt journalistisch abdecken. Ja, danke.
I wanted to say something also. If you have some ideas about features that have to be integrated to the KED, please let me know. Go to www.openhardware.de and write an email to Webmaster, because if we make the schematic, the slots for changing the specification is closed, so we'll only have one shot of the FP, of the board. Okay, that's it.
Ja, dann danke euch allen für die Aufmerksamkeit. Yeah, thank you for the attention. Have fun.